Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
President Donald Trump is not the first candidate to dispute the results of a U.S. presidential election. The United States has had several highly contested elections in the past. Here are a few of them. The disputed presidential election of 2000 led to changes to voting systems in many states across the country. Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore were the two main candidates. The dispute over votes centered on a few counties in the state of Florida. After legal action by both sides, the result was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court on December 12, 2000. Gore lost the election, although his supporters note that he won the popular vote. The United States elects presidents through a system called the Electoral College. That system gives each state a certain number of votes. A candidate needs at least 270 electoral votes to gain the presidency. Robert Spiel is a professor of political science at Penn State University in Erie, Pennsylvania. He said that in 2000, much of the United States used a punch card ballot system using mechanical voting machines. Spiel said, "Unknown to most Americans, every year thousands of ballots were getting thrown out because that punch card system was malfunctioning and also was confusing voters." Election officials knew that and hadn't told anyone, and it didn't become public until that election, he said. Spiel went on to say that the election of 2000 led to more modern voting systems being used in the United States. Alexander Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. He said, "Al Gore had an opportunity to question the legitimacy of some of those votes." However, Cohen argued that Gore chose not to because it would be damaging to democracy to keep fighting. The 1960 presidential election between Democrat John F. Kennedy and Republican Richard Nixon also was notable for accusations of cheating. Republicans suspected that Chicago Mayor Richard Daley provided just enough votes to give Kennedy the state of Illinois and the presidency. There also were questions about voting numbers in several other states. After considering it, Nixon decided not to seek court action. Some historians say that the 1876 contested election between Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and Democrat Samuel Tilden had long-term bad results. They say the deal to settle the election resulted in discriminatory laws in the American South that hurt black Americans. That year, Both parties claimed they had won a majority in the Electoral College. The election was decided by the U.S. House of Representatives, as the U.S. Constitution provides. The Democratic Party was the majority party in the South during the Civil War, which ended in 1865. Democratic lawmakers eventually conceded to Republican lawmakers in exchange for a withdrawal of Union forces from the South. Hayes was then elected president. But historians say the Union forces were also protecting the civil rights of the former slaves. In the years that followed, they say, discriminatory laws that separated the races were put in place in the South. Penn State University's Spiel said, "Very quickly, the political leaders who had been leading in the South before the American Civil War and who had supported slavery again rose to the top and began dominating politics again in the South." He said that led to the loss of almost all political and social rights for African Americans. The election of 1888 was marked by accusations of buying votes or bribing voters. Democrat incumbent Grover Cleveland faced Republican Benjamin Harrison in that election. In those days, ballots were given out by the political parties. Some votes were taken publicly. Some people, known as floaters, sold their votes to whoever would pay the most. A letter sent by the Republican National Committee told party workers to divide voters into groups of five. They were told to pay them to vote for the Republican candidate. The resulting situation led to the end of public ballots. That particular election, in which there were widespread accusations of corruption, led to the adoption of the secret ballot nationwide, where Americans now vote privately without people knowing how they vote, Spiel said. Cohen looks to the failure of democracies in Latin America and Africa when considering the effects of questioning the integrity of voting. Cohen said, "People have to believe that the political system is fair and that their votes matter for democracy to succeed." Cohen went on to say that, "Once you take the position that our votes don't count because there are so many other fraudulent votes out there, you're inspiring people to revolt because you're arguing that democracy isn't working." Cohen said that, so far in the 2020 election, he does not see that any lasting damage has been done to American democracy. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
American drug maker Pfizer says its experimental vaccine appears to be more than 90% effective in preventing COVID-19. The information came Monday from early results of a Phase 3 study involving about 44,000 volunteers in the United States and other countries. An independent group of scientists also examined the study. Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech, are the first drug makers to show successful data from a large Phase 3 trial of a coronavirus vaccine. The companies also said they have found no serious safety concerns in the testing so far. Albert Bourla is Pfizer's chairman and chief. He said in a statement, "Today is a great day for science and humanity. The first set of results from our Phase 3 COVID-19 vaccine trial provides the initial evidence of our vaccine's ability to prevent COVID-19. Bourla added, "With today's news, we are a significant step closer to providing people around the world with a much-needed breakthrough to help bring an end to this global health crisis. We look forward to sharing additional efficacy and safety data generated from thousands of participants in the coming weeks." Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center reported that the health crisis has infected more than 50 million people around the world, with 1.2 million deaths. Jesse Goodman is an infectious diseases expert at Georgetown University and a former FDA chief scientist. He told the Associated Press, "We need to see the data, but this is extremely promising." Dr. Goodman noted several questions that remain to be answered, including how long the vaccine's effects last and whether it protects older people as well as younger people. "It's going to be a while before this has a major impact at the population level," he said. In order to receive FDA's emergency use permission, Pfizer will need to present at least 2 months of safety data collected on the study's 44,000 volunteers. The information is expected to come by the third week of November. Drug makers Pfizer and BioNTech will continue to follow the study volunteers for another 2 years after their second vaccine treatment. Pfizer said the early finding involved 94 volunteers in the trial who developed COVID-19. Volunteers in the late Phase 3 study and the researchers do not know who received the real experimental vaccine or an inactive substance. The drug maker did not say how many of those who got COVID-19 had been treated with the vaccine candidate. However, a 90% effectiveness suggests that about 8 out of the 94 volunteers who caught COVID-19 had received the experimental vaccine. Pfizer plans to continue the study until it records 164 COVID-19 infections among all the volunteers. That is a number that the FDA says is enough to tell how well the vaccine is working. The agency requires a vaccine be at least 50% effective for emergency use. The data has yet to be re-examined or published in a medical journal. Pfizer and BioNTech said it would take action once it has results from the entire trial. Pfizer and BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine uses a biotechnology called messenger RNA or mRNA. The genetically engineered material causes the body to create a protein to protect against the virus. No mRNA technology has ever been approved for use in people. The material can be created and manufactured in weeks, much faster than conventional vaccines. Pfizer and BioNTech have a $1.95 billion contract with the United States government to provide 100 million vaccine treatments. They have also reached agreements with the European Union, Britain, Canada, and Japan. Pfizer said it expects to produce up to 50 million doses of vaccine in 2020 and up to 1.3 billion doses in 2021. American drug maker Moderna also uses messenger RNA technology in their Phase 3 experimental vaccine. Other COVID-19 vaccine candidates in Phase 3 trials come from drug companies Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, which is working with the University of Oxford. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In any war, the enemy's capital city is an important target. To capture the enemy's capital usually means victory. In the American Civil War, the North hoped for a quick victory by capturing the southern capital at Richmond, Virginia. Northern forces were strong enough. There were about 150,000 Union soldiers in and around Washington. General George McClellan led this Army of the Potomac. It was the biggest, best trained, and best equipped of the Union armies. Larry West and Tony Riggs report on McClellan's move against Richmond.
For the first year of the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac did not fight. General McClellan kept making excuses for his failure to act. He had a plan, he said, and he would not move until he was sure his men were ready. McClellan's plan was to put his army on boats in the Potomac River. They would sail down the river to where it emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. Then he would land the boats on the coast of Virginia, east of Richmond. President Abraham Lincoln wanted to capture the Confederate capital, but he did not like the idea of moving all of McClellan's men. That would leave the city of Washington without protection. McClellan tried to calm Lincoln's fears. He said that as soon as he marched toward Richmond, any Confederate soldiers near Washington would withdraw. They would be needed to defend their own capital.
The Army of the Potomac began to move on March 17th, 1862. Within 2 weeks, more than 50,000 had reached Fort Monroe, southeast of Richmond. They were equipped with 100 big guns and tons of supplies. Day by day, the Union force at Fort Monroe grew larger. McClellan had planned to move quickly to Yorktown, then push on to Richmond. He would move along the finger of land between the York River and the James River. He soon learned, however, that he could not move as quickly as planned. Heavy spring rains had turned the dirt roads into rivers of mud. McClellan's men could push through, but there was no way they could bring their big guns. McClellan decided to wait. He did not want to attack Yorktown without artillery.
President Lincoln was not pleased. He sent a message to McClellan. "You must strike a blow," Lincoln said. "You must act." But still, McClellan delayed. By the time his artillery had arrived and was in place, Confederate troops had withdrawn. They moved to the woods outside Williamsburg. McClellan chased them. For the first time, his army went into battle. The fighting was strange. The woods were so thick that the two sides could not often see each other. Soldiers fired at the flash of gunpowder, at noises, anything that moved. Their aim was good enough. About 4,000 soldiers were killed.
In his reports to Washington, McClellan claimed great victories at Yorktown and Williamsburg. Yet he was worried. He believed the Confederate force around Richmond was much larger than his. He demanded more men. The Confederate force was, in fact, much smaller than the Union force. But it was deployed in a way to make it seem much larger. The trick fooled McClellan. By the middle of May, 1862, his army was only 15 kilometers from Richmond. Still, he did not attack. He continued to wait for more men and equipment. Confederate President Jefferson Davis was worried. He knew the Confederate army was smaller than the Union army. Davis's military advisor, General Robert E. Lee, offered a plan. Lee proposed that General Stonewall Jackson lead his army up Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. The North would see the move as a threat to Washington. Union troops would be kept near Washington instead of being sent to Richmond. President Davis agreed. Orders were sent to Jackson.
Stonewall Jackson was one of the South's best generals. He was a forceful leader, and he could make his men march until they dropped. He got the name Stonewall at the Battle of Bull Run in the summer of 1861. Southern soldiers were withdrawing. A Confederate officer tried to stop them. He urged them to follow Jackson's example, to stand and fight. He shouted, "There stands Jackson, like a stone wall." General Jackson faced three large Union forces in and around the Shenandoah Valley. Yet he struck hard and fast, and soon had control of the valley's main towns. His campaign is still studied at military schools around the world. It is considered an excellent example of how to move troops quickly to where they are most needed.
Jackson's raids produced the exact effect Robert E. Lee had wanted. Everyone in Washington feared an immediate attack on the city. Soldiers were hurried to the capital from Baltimore and other nearby cities. And President Lincoln sent thousands of troops to chase Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley instead of helping McClellan at Richmond. The Union Army outside Richmond was deployed on either side of the Chickahominy River. The Chickahominy was not a big river. It could be crossed easily at several places. While McClellan waited to attack the Confederate capital, heavy rains began to fall. The little river began to rise. The commander of Confederate forces in Richmond saw this as a chance to smash a large part of McClellan's army.
The flooding river would soon cut the Union force completely in two. When that happened, the Confederates would attack. They expected to destroy at least half of McClellan's army. The plan seemed good, and after the first few hours of battle, the Confederates were close to victory. But one bridge remained over the Chickahominy River. Union soldiers were able to cross it. The Confederates were forced to withdraw to their earlier positions. No ground was gained, and more than 11,000 men were killed or wounded. Among the wounded was the commander of all Confederate forces, General Joe Johnston. General Robert E. Lee would take his place.
Lee wasted no time. He wanted to push the Union Army far away from Richmond. First, however, he wanted more information about his enemy. He sent a young officer, Jeb Stuart, to get it. Stuart set off with more than 1,000 men on horseback. Theirs was a wild ride around the edge of the Union Army. When they reported back 3 days later, General Lee knew exactly where he would attack. It would be the first in a series of battles known as the 7 Days Campaign.
Lee took a big chance. He moved most of his men into position to attack what he now knew was the weak right side of the Union line. He left only a few thousand men to defend Richmond. He hoped the Union commander, McClellan, would be fooled by this plan. For if McClellan discovered how few men were left behind, he could smash through easily and capture the city. With the help of Stonewall Jackson's army, Lee's plan worked. McClellan was fooled. And after a day of fierce fighting, he was forced to withdraw from the area.
Lee chased McClellan for a while. They clashed at such places as Mechanicsville, White Oak Swamp, and finally Malvern Hill. The South won the 7 Days Campaign. The threat to Richmond was ended. The Confederacy was saved. But victory came at a terrible price. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed or wounded. As both the North and South were learning quickly, the Civil War was becoming more costly than anyone had imagined.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.